Talk with Dan Clark on FUBAR Radio.
Hello and welcome to Screen Talk. It's finally summer. We have sunshine. I'm so happy. My girlfriend tells me off for talking about the weather too much, both at home and on the podcast, but it means a lot to me. We are going to crack straight on. I'm going to bring on to the show a man who's not been here for a couple of weeks, Mr. James Gill. He brings us news. He brings us reviews. I think reviews. You're going to talk about Wiener Dog? Wiener? Well, how do you say it?
Wiener Dog.
Wiener. Should we call the whole thing off? I mean, what is it? Wiener? Wiener?
Wiener.
Is it?
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah, I mean, I think over here we just say hot dogs.
Yeah.
But in America.
That's why I'm confused.
Wiener dog.
First of all, what news is out there, James? How are you, by the way? Just quickly.
I'm good. How are you, Dan? Last time we spoke, you had a slight cold.
I was a bit all over the place, wasn't I?
Well, no. I think when someone has a cold, if they sound like a sexy Kathleen, not that there's an unsexy Kathleen Turner.
Yeah.
But you were bringing a bit of that Kathleen Turner vibe, my friend.
Oh, cool. Okay.
I never thought I'd say that out loud.
When she appeared in Friends, that's what you mean. Yeah.
We talked about that before, haven't we? Yeah. What a brave performance. Yeah. Oh, Kathleen.
So what's happening in the world of movies and television?
Well, I am mindful that we probably talk about Star Wars a bit too much.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously there's a new Rogue One trailer out,
mm-hmm.
and there's also the rumour that Donald Glover... And again, I've talked about Community. It's very niche. Look at me chastising myself on the show. But there's a rumour that Donald Glover...
Trust the audience that listen to this, that they'll either know the show already or they'll watch it afterwards.
But anyway, so I love that also you
referenced a 80s game show as well. You have a bit of a... Like, you've mentioned... over the weeks, you've mentioned Russ Abbott being a hero of yours.
Legend.
Halen Pace.
Yes, underrated.
Who else? There was a couple of them.
Oh, there's been
like
many.
Were born in the wrong era, weren't you?
Or the right era.
Because you saw them. But if you had been your age in the 70s and 80s...
I think I would have...
Light entertainment
Davro, Les... this is a true story. When Dustin G tragically died from a heart attack backstage during a pantomime with Les Dennis, I was 7 years old. If there's a way of telling Les this, I hand wrote, with the help of a primary school teacher, I hand wrote a letter of my condolences to Les Dennis.
Wow.
And Les Dennis sent me a signed photo in the post.
Oh.
And somewhere down the years, I've lost that signed photo.
Yeah,
I wonder. Can you tell how much it hurts me? I do have a tremendous affinity for people like Dennis and Abbott and those guys.
Well,
yeah,
it's good, because normally, but people in the comedy world and the comedy scene, myself included, will cite the more alternative generation of comics.
But I love that as well. So I've said to a friend who's a comedy fan, I would express my love for, say, Adam Sandler, and he would quite snoop. The fact that this happened about 10 years ago and it still upsets me. And he said, yeah, well, I'd prefer more Iannucci and Coogan myself. And I'm like, yeah, I like those too, you gibbering pillock. You are allowed to like more than one thing. So I have very broad taste, is what I'm saying. So I do have mainstream sensibilities, but that doesn't mean that I can't also like the more cerebral
stuff. And also, you called someone a pillock when you were really angry. So you...
Pillock's a great word. I'm bringing back pillock. Hashtag pillock. Great word. Yes.
So Star Wars.
As we were saying, Star Wars. So the rumor is that Donald Glover... That was 5 minutes of gold. So Donald Glover has been strongly linked with the role of young Lando Calrissian in the Han Solo prequel. And if that's true, and if you love Star Wars like I love Star Wars, and if you love Donald Glover, that is joyous news, isn't it?
I don't even know who Donald Glover is.
Have you ever seen Community?
I've seen a couple of episodes. It wasn't, you know, I appreciated it, but it wasn't something that grabbed me.
I know that you're a busy chap.
Yeah.
I know that since James Brown passed away, you are the busiest man in the business we call show.
Yeah.
But promise me, when the producer laughs, that's always a good sign. Promise me, when you get some spare time, strap in and watch 10 episodes of Community.
Strap in.
It's joyous. And Donald Glover is such a talent. And the fact that he left that show under something of a cloud, it's rather sad when he left. So I would again, channeling my Kevin Keegan, I would love it if Donald Glover is playing Lando Calrissian.
I'm going to say me too, even though I'm not fully aware of his work.
Well, if you thought that was niche, this is even more niche. So I know that you're a big fan of Saturday Night Live.
Yes.
And two of the brightest stars, Taron Killam and Jay Farrow, found out that their contracts are not being renewed. Now, you might be listening thinking, I don't know who these guys are, but in the US, these are two of the main players on SNL. Mm-hmm. So in the same way that in the early 90s, you wouldn't necessarily, well, you probably definitely wouldn't have known who Adam Sandler was, but the exact same thing happened to him. And he was allegedly, reportedly, when Sandler is asked, were you sacked? He sort of says, well, I don't know, because he's such a nice guy. Mm-hmm. I don't think he likes to, you know,
say it,
rake over the, yeah, exactly. Anyway, so what I would say is that Taron Killam and Jay Pharoah, if you're not familiar with them, YouTube them, Google them. These boys are going to be massive. They will be breakout stars. Taron Killam does a Matthew McConaughey impression, and he once did it in front of Woody Harrelson at the time of True Detective. And watch Woody Harrelson live on air. Try not to laugh. It is amazing.
There's been a few people over the years that either got fired or left too soon from SNL that went on to have amazing careers.
Exactly. So this is more me. So there's been a, look, I'm going to blow my own trumpet. There have been a couple of things that I've said. I feel dreadful saying this out loud. That have come good, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. What I'm saying is, in the past, a lot of people left SNL to become gargantuan stars. Bill Murray's obvious. Eddie Murphy's obvious. Adam Sandler. Mike Myers. And I think these boys are special. There's Taron Killam and Jay Pharoah.
There's a few surprising ones. Robert Downey Jr. did it for 1 year. Didn't get renewed.
That's right. Morwenna Banks did it for 1 year, you know.
Did she?
Yeah, she did.
There's also someone else, and I used to know this off the top of my head.
Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
Did she do it? Yeah.
And then also, there was, in the mid-80s, they were flagging, and they called in some of the big guns.
Yeah.
So normally what they do is they bring up-and-comers, they turn them into stars, and everyone's happy. In the mid-80s, they brought in Harry Shearer.
That's right.
Michael McKean and Billy Crystal. Oh my God, can you imagine? So Crystal was quite a big star. He'd had the success of Soap. Can you imagine if they did that now? And they brought those three guys in, and it worked a treat. You know, it's a bit like when Liverpool signed Gary McAllister. He was in his late 30s. Everyone thought, this is raising an eyebrow.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And McAllister won the treble with Liverpool.
I have no idea what you're talking about. I mean,
I've got niche within niche. Anyway.
You're going niche within niche.
Niche within niche.
So can I ask you something?
Yes, you can.
Just before you go on to your next subject, I haven't seen Suicide Squad yet.
Yes.
What do we make of the fact that it is possibly one of the worst reviewed films of the summer blockbusters, and yet went on to make shit loads of money? In a similar vein to Batman versus Superman, or is it the other way around?
So I will try, as you know, I'm a very positive, I'm possibly too positive, so I will try be as matter of fact as possible, okay? That is fair.
I'd like you to sort of maybe not be matter of fact.
I'm going to try to be as matter of fact as possible.
Yeah.
So I would say what happened with Suicide Squad is the reason why it made so much money is because there were a lot of pre-booked tickets. So people were estimating that the movie would take roughly around 150 million in its opening weekend, and a lot of that was
which is insane, by the way. Is that internationally or domestically? That's got to be international.
That made international, but it did really well in the US on its own. But a lot of that was because people had already bought their tickets,
right?
And so what may happen is it may have what is called a second week drop off.
Yeah, yeah.
If it doesn't have much of a second week drop off, it may have a third week drop off. And so some experts were suggesting that film would need to make around 800 million worldwide to be deemed a success. Now, you may be spitting out your tea at home listening to that, but don't forget that Batman versus Superman made something in the region of 900 million worldwide. And for some people, can you believe that? What a time to be alive. For some people, that film hasn't been deemed the mega smash it thought. It was thought that because it took less than a billion, can you believe these words are coming out of my mouth? Because it took less than a billion, it wasn't deemed the smash that many thought it would be. And it's similar for Suicide Squad. So it's aiming for around 800. I would be surprised if it manages to hit that, because I would say the reviews have been so harsh, haven't they?
Yeah. Well, the weird thing is, some people may not know this, but when films are made, you say it needs to make 800 million to even be considered, you know, successful, you know, and that's probably not even as successful as they would have hoped. But that's the budget of the film's like 150 million or 200 million
but
max.
That doesn't even factor in. But then the marketing campaign.
Surely, what's that? That's 600 million in marketing.
It won't be that much, but I think they're just factoring in how much profit they were expecting to make on a film like this.
It's just insane.
The marketing campaign on Suicide Squad And again, being matter of fact, it was brilliant because it's a film.
The trailers were really good.
The trailers
were
fantastic. Yeah. That you've seen the posters all over the country, and it's a film that people have been talking about month in, month out. So, and I think their marketing campaign was so good that was part of the reason why some of the Star Trek fans were upset that Star Trek Beyond hadn't had the similar levels of coverage. So, Star Trek Beyond, it had a bit of a ramp up towards its release. But Suicide Squad, people have been talking about this film for months, in the same way that you might talk about a Star Wars movie. Mm-hmm. I mean, the people at Warner's, whoever marketed this movie, dudes, give yourselves a pat on the back because you did a great job.
So actually, that was the thing. That was the reason I brought this up, was because what I wanted to say is, on the one hand, I think it's great when a film gets negative reviews and then still does well. I've mentioned this before about TV shows, just to sort of highlight that maybe the critics, A, don't have as much power as they used to, and B, don't necessarily know what the general public like. Flip side of that is the cynical counter argument is, well, what's worse, like critics having control of what people see, or people who market movies, you know, the people behind the marketing? But like, you know, who's...
But I would also say that the proof will be in the pudding, and it's, I think it would make more sense to judge how successful the film has been after a few weeks.
Well, also, forgetting the box office for a bit, there were some people did actually, like, some people did give it good reviews. I mean,
a couple of my mates at Empire, they both really enjoyed it, you know, so, and they gave it 4 stars. So some people have loved it, but it is laughable. I did laugh when some people were attacking Rotten Tomatoes, because I think Rotten Tomatoes is a wonderful thing, and all it's doing is just holding a mirror back up to what people have said. So Rotten Tomatoes' crime was doing their job. They'd done was, these are the
reviews.
Well,
they hadn't done anything, really.
Yeah, exactly. All they're saying is, these are the reviews that this film has
and
got.
And people went, stop telling everyone what the reviews are.
Rotten Tomatoes. That's what people are saying. You're like, well, no. I think Rotten Tomatoes is great, because if you want to, let's say you want to take your family out, your missus out, your husband out, you want to check out your little at a glance reviews. Rotten Tomatoes does a wonderful job because it's got a cross section of all sorts of reviews.
You wait until you spend 3 years of your life making a movie, Rotten Tomatoes is highlighting all the negative things people are saying. Then we'll see if you think it's a good thing.
I mean,
I agree. I think all it is just it's no different to, you know, just having 7 newspapers in front of you and going, right, what's the general consensus?
Exactly, that's all it is.
Yeah.
Well, I tell you what, that is fascinating. So, I've been a lucky chap in this job, and that I get to see films from the pretty much from the start to the very end. And so I've been on, say, a set visit, and so you get to appreciate just how many people work on a film, how much work goes into a film, how many months it goes on for, then all the post-production stuff. You know, I've met chaps when they're in post-production, that goes on for months. Then on top of that, you've got the press campaign. So like you say, it can be from start to finish. 3 years is probably about accurate. I mean, you said that off the top of your head. I think you're absolutely bang.
Well, I know people that have started who write films as well, and they've said, you know, it's been 6 years in the making.
Absolutely.
You know, so,
and there can be no more heartbreaking thing that you say you've spent six years of your life, you know, body and soul, night and day. You've missed the kids growing up, and then the film comes out, and someone comes and watches and goes, "Crap!"
I mean, it's painful.
My God.
And I do think it's. Well, look, I mean, that's their job. They're
that's
meant
their
to review
job.
It, but
and you know, and on the critic side, they would say, "Well, I went to journalism school. I've been writing about movies,
but no one's reviewing
years.
Your journalistic skills."
Well, then you got message boards, and they do review the journalistic
skills.
Yeah,
but now we're getting niche again. So, what else we got before we have to wrap up, because we've got a short one?
You're joking.
Yeah,
I tell you what, I could talk all day. Well, I would say, we do talk a lot about mainstream movies, and there's a slightly left of the middle movie out this week called Wiener Dog by Todd Solondz.
I'm surprised you're saying left. I would have thought this was really, really left field.
It is. I mean,
knowing Todd Solondz, Solondz.
Let's call
the whole thing off. Wiener. Knowing his previous work, I would have said this was like properly. Like left field.
Absolutely. And so I went to a preview screening for this a few weeks ago, and those of us who were laughing, if you have a nice dark sense of humour, I mean, some people, including myself, were belly laughing, because some of the humour is so dark. And obviously, I imagine some people were not laughing. So the wonderful thing about Todd Solondz is he's not going to be everyone's cup of tea, and that, you know, he's perfectly fine with that. So the plot line of this movie is, there is a lovable Dachshund, and it is passed from owner to owner. So it's like portmanteau style. style. So you've got, for one section, Danny DeVito is the owner of the dog. He's an aspiring screenwriter. And then there's another section, Ellen Burstyn is an elderly woman who's bailing out her unreliable granddaughter. And she's the owner of the dog. And then it gets passed from owner to owner, okay, for a variety of reasons.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a lovely premise, and there are some wonderful performances. And even if there's a section you don't like, don't worry, because in 5-10 minutes time the dog gets a new owner.
So is it a bit more like Shortcuts or one of these multi-strand story films?
It is, but not as epic or cinematic, yeah, as Shortcuts. It's more punchy, almost sketch style, if right, you like. But if I was going to pick out some men of the match, DeVito is a, yeah, joy as the screenwriter, and Ellen Burstyn, who she's an icon of cinema. She's wonderful as this elderly owner. So yeah, that'll be my recommendation, mm-hmm, of the week. It's something unusual. It's something different. But Wiener Dog is a lot of fun.
Does it go as dark as Happiness?
No.
Okay.
No. I mean Happiness. Oh yeah, my, yeah, goodness. I mean, there's a scene in Happiness with Dylan Baker where he has to break it to his son that he is of a certain disposition,
yeah,
and I think that is one of the great moments in cinema.
Yeah,
I got,
yeah,
to,
yeah,
interview Todd Solondz about a week ago.
Really?
And I said that moment, and obviously there's a scene in Happiness that involves a teenage boy, a Labrador, licking the pole at, yeah, at the apartment. I mean, it's, if you've seen Happiness, you'll know what I'm talking,
yeah,
about.
Yeah.
If you haven't, be careful. But it's wonderful. And again, Philip Seymour Hoffman's in that.
Is it? What? In Wiener Dog?
No, in Happiness. Oh, right. If you've not seen Happiness.
What am I saying? Wiener, Wiener. I keep getting that
call
wrong.
Call it whatever you like, my friend.
Well, I'm excited to see it. And I'm surprised it's released this time of year, in a way.
But tell you what, if you're the sort of person that thinks some people are a bit too cheerful during the summer, go, yeah, pay your £10 and watch Wiener Dog.
Well, James, a pleasure as always. Next week,
let's talk
for a bit longer, and let's talk about some of the things we've accumulated, only slightly touched upon over the weeks. Thank you very much.
Thanks, mate.
Screen Talk with Dan Clark on FUBAR Radio.
So before we welcome my next guest, I'm going to play the first of his two songs which he's chosen. There's a specific reason he chose this song. It features in his Guilty Pleasure choice, which I won't mention yet. I watched it last night, and my God, it's a contender for one of the worst best. I never know whether it's worst or best when it's a guilty pleasure. Anyway, this song is a song by an artist who was coincidentally my absolute icon when I was about 13. I thought he was the coolest man on the planet. This was obviously before I discovered pot and music from the 60s. I loved him so hard. I even broke up, right, this is how much I wanted to be like him. I broke open a tea bag, emptied the tea leaves, and then stuck the tea leaves to my face to create a designer stubble, because that's how much like him I wanted to be. I am, of course, talking about the man who pioneered the designer stubble, Mr. George Michael, and this is the song Faith.
Well, I guess it would be nice if I could touch your body. I know not everybody has got a body like you, but I gotta think twice before I give my heart away. And I know all the games you play, because I play them too. Baby, I know you're asking me to stay. Say please, please, please don't go away. It's
Cause I gotta have faith. Ooh, I gotta have faith. Because I gotta have faith, faith, faith. I gotta have faith, faith, faith.
Oh, George, my hero, or was my hero, well, not, you know, just as a 13-year-old, he was the epitome of cool. So joining me today is one half of the powerhouse duo behind Peep Show and Fresh Meat. He's a writer, producer, and this I didn't know about, a novelist. He's giving me a fairly confident little raise of the eyebrow. I didn't know about this. I am, of course, talking about Mr. Sam Bain. You wrote a novel. I did a little bit of research, yes. Which does just mean looking on Wikipedia. just in case there were things, you know, there were a couple of things on there that I'd either wasn't aware of or a few things that were like, oh, yeah, of course he did that. But the book I didn't know about.
Yeah, I wrote it... 22 years ago.
What? Mm-hmm. It was published in 2002, it said.
Yes.
Yeah.
8 years later.
Okay, so this was obviously before you worked in TV.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and what, you wanted to be a novelist?
I did.
Yeah?
And that's why I wrote a novel.
This is, by the way, I'm not going to give it away yet. This is also why you've picked your guilty pleasure. I sort of see there's maybe a subliminal thing, but we'll get to that in a bit. Okay. So did you write the book, hate the experience, and went, I'd rather write TV, or did you like the experience?
I wrote the book, but the publishers hated the experience of reading it.
Oh, God.
So 8 years later, I finally got it published through a small, cool little press. But it was, yeah, it was really nice to get it finally out there.
Yeah, I bet. I mean, I've thought about... you know, book writing and not doing it, because the thing that always freaks me out is not the first draft, but going back and rewriting a book. It seems like, oh my God, where do you even... Obviously, you start at the beginning, but like 300... It's not like, you know, how scripts, the dialogue, you know, a script probably is... If you... percentage in terms of words, inks per page is about 30% because of the way the...
Yeah.
But a book is, that's a lot of words.
Well, my book was pretty short.
Was it?
It was only like 40,000 words. It's kind of a novella in a way. But yeah, a proper book. Yeah, a lot of work. But, you know, it is probably the best writing experience I've had in some ways.
Really?
You're completely in control of everything, unlike TV and film.
But you wrote it without knowing whether it would ever get published.
Correct.
Was that a freedom or a fear?
Well, I wrote it on an MA course at Manchester.
Ah.
Creative writing, MA, so...
Is this just your dissertation published?
Basically.
Is it?
Yeah.
It is?
Well, it was my dissertation for that MA.
Okay. Okay. Well, maybe more people should get their dissertations published. So you enjoy writing, obviously you do lots of writing. Do you prefer doing that kind of thing where you're on your own, or do you like working? Because I know you do, obviously you work with Jesse as a duo, you've had teams on Fresh Meat,
yes,
and you've written solely on your own. Do you have a preference out of any of those three?
Well, I think writing on your own is probably the toughest, but the flip side is can be the most rewarding,
mm-hmm.
because you can write something that's completely your own. Writing with a partner is really fun if it works. Obviously, if it doesn't, it's a nightmare. It's like a bad marriage.
Yeah.
But if it works, and me and Jesse have worked together for 20 years, it's like a dream, because you can just make sure they laugh and keep your spirits up when they're low.
Yeah.
So it's pretty amazing.
If one of you's having a bad day, the other one might be able to like push
very
you
much
through.
So.
Yeah.
And someone to kind of report to, so you never lose, you never just write off a week,
mm-hmm.
stay in bed, you kind of keep going, and there's lots of things to recommend. It's obviously very common in comedy.
Yeah, do you write together at the laptop, or do you go off and then send each other things?
Yeah, we do all the outlining together, so mm-hmm. we'd like create a show together in the same room and outline an episode in the same room, but then we'd go and write the dialogue
mm-hmm.
separately and email. Yeah.
And can you tell the difference between, like, obviously we can't, but could someone close to you go, oh, that's definitely a Sam bit of dialogue, or that's a, or have you become so, you know, the same thing on those shows that you work together?
Well, it's an interesting question, that. I mean, I think on Peep Show, probably no. And, you know, we do get other writers in, like John Brown, Simon Blackwell, Tom mm-hmm. Basden, and so you're writing to those characters, so hopefully you wouldn't notice who wrote what.
Yeah, and that didn't happen until later on in the
series,
right? So
correct,
it's so set up by then, right?
Yeah. But I don't know, I think me and Jesse are doing more solo writing now, and if and when those scripts get made, maybe it'd be interesting to see for people the differences, because maybe I'm not so aware of them myself.
No, we probably sometimes it's like when you write something and someone says, well, what kind of style is it? Sometimes it takes someone else to tell you, because you're like, well, I've just written something I wanted to write, I didn't know it was a sort of French new wave thriller. I've never written one of those, that's for sure. Is there a kind of thing that that you like to do more, but Jesse's, I prefer, you know, do you have slight shifts where he wants to make things a bit more weird, or you like things more weird, or one of you likes more rude stuff, or are you both totally on the same page with everything?
No, I think, you know, and also the stuff we choose to write together is stuff that we share. I mean, he used to work for an MP and he's run into politics, so I guess writing for the thick of it and Veep, which he's done, which I haven't, is sort of symptomatic of that. But no, in terms of actual sense of humour, we're very compatible, very much the same.
Yeah. When did it start? When did this duo, this relationship begin?
I sent him a feature film script that I'd written in 1995.
Right.
Which was pretty terrible.
How did you know him? I mean,
we met at university.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Creative writing course. So
you didn't just guess an email and it.
No, I didn't just randomly write to a bloke in Oswestry, which is where he's from. No, we met at Manchester on a creative writing course. So we'd been writing short stories and poetry and seeing each other in class, and we shared a house for a year.
Okay.
And then I sent him this script, which was pretty awful, but he did like some of the jokes.
Yeah.
And he thought, well, maybe we could write a sitcom, because we both like sitcom. And we tried, and like, there was chemistry, basically. It just worked. So we thought, well, this is good, and sitcoms actually might pay some money, unlike my novel, which hadn't paid anything at that point. So that's where it started.
I've had this weird thing where I've worked in groups and on my own, and I've tried writing with people who I get on so well with socially, or even I'm thinking of one instance where it was someone I've acted with quite a few times, and we just have such great chemistry as performers. We get on really well socially. There's just nothing about our friendship or dynamic that there's nothing negative about it, and yet we tried to write together and it just didn't work. And you're like, what is that? We couldn't work it out either. We couldn't work out what that thing, that alchemy thing is.
Yeah.
But to have found someone that early on in your career that you work so well with, I mean, surely now that you guys go off and do your separate things, you must be like, wow, that's quite a rare and amazing thing.
Well, I think to our credit, we've always appreciated how rare and amazing it is.
Yeah.
So we were very keen to keep it going and not be one of the many partnerships you break up acrimoniously, which does happen.
Yeah,
because like you said, there's chemistry. You know, it's like there's no real reason why it should work with some people and not others, but it just does. And we're aware of that quite early on.
Did you write different scripts or pitch different ideas before you got to Peep Show? I mean,
We had like a 5-year apprenticeship of a series of disasters and missteps and drafts and almost nearlies and heartache, but we were still, you know, writing professionally, which is a big achievement in itself. So we weren't like too unhappy.
Yeah.
We just didn't get our shot to a Peep Show properly.
Now I've heard what came first, like with Peep Show. I'm sure you've said every single thing you can possibly say about this show. I mean, it ran for an incredible 10 seasons, right? Series.
Well, nine.
Nine. Oh, okay.
It's annoying for the completists.
Oh, yeah.
Like, our mutual friend Ian Morris hates the fact that it's nine. He's like, well, 10. It's got to be 10.
10.
You don't have
that's
the
so
top
round.
Nine. You don't have the magnificent nine.
No, that is true.
It's
although,
10.
Yeah. Oh, you have nine the musical, but that's not a list of people. I think I've just rounded it off to 10 just because it sounds better.
Feel free to spread that misinformation.
Okay. All right.
Because it might make Ian happy.
Yeah. Ian, you made 10. You were involved in 10 shows series. You did that for 9 series, 10, and was it the concept or the characters that came first?
Well. That's a tricky question to answer because the simple answer is we had the concept and then we sort of imported the characters from another script which had bit in the dust.
Yeah.
So we had this script which we were writing with Michelin Webb, the BBC, and Gareth Edwards produced, and it was good scripts, but they just didn't get made. But we sort of had the prototypes of those characters, of Mark, Jeremy and Superhands and Tony in that script. And we thought they were lying around unused, and we loved the characters. So we kind of had a concept of the POV and the voiceover, which you could almost use on any subject. So we thought, well, why not use it on these characters which we like?
Yeah.
And developed it more.
Well, I often say to people who have just started out writing, why they're listening to me, I don't know, but if they do ask for advice or they're getting down about something that they've worked on and it's been rejected, I say, look, there's stuff never dies completely, because like what you've just said, you, even if it doesn't come back to life, which sometimes it does, like 2 years later there's new commissioning editors and they like something you wrote 2 years ago, but also you can take stuff from a script, whether it's a storyline or a character or something. So nothing is, you should never think, well, that's just, I've failed, that's dead.
Totally agree. And in fact, you know, like I said earlier, Jesse read that feature film I wrote, 95, which is the worst thing I've ever written, I would say, but in some ways the most important thing I ever wrote, because if I hadn't, and he hadn't read it and realised I was serious about writing scripts, we probably never would have worked together.
Yeah. So it completely had a function.
Yeah.
100%. Yeah. So I hear they're, and this makes me laugh because I've been in this experience, I hear they're going to give Peep Show another go in America.
Third time lucky.
So what's gone wrong before?
Well, the first one is on YouTube. I think that speaks for itself.
Is it really?
Yeah. They dropped a lot of the POV camera work.
Okay, because I heard, I thought this was just folklore that people had exaggerated, but I heard that the Americans went, first of all, they said, do the guys have to be like, you know, can they be better looking and like toned and,
yeah, there's a
you
bit
know,
of that.
And do we have to have the POV thing?
Yeah, that is like, basically true. I think they have it a little bit. I haven't watched it for years for obvious reasons. I'm not a massive fan of pain.
But it rhymes with your name, so you should
be.
I should be
more into pain.
You should change your surname to Sam Payne. Yeah, P.I.
They did do it that. And the second one never got aired. It was just a sort of non-broadcast pilot, which I think was all right. But, you know, it's just very hard to recapture the chemistry. I mean, we wrote those characters for Mission and Web.
Yeah.
And, you know,
because you'd developed something with them before.
Because we knew them, we'd worked on them, on this script with the BBC with them that I mentioned, and we just knew they were going to be brilliant, and we were obviously right about that and lucky to have them. And so when you make a suit that's, you know, bespoke for someone, then you can't just fit it onto anyone. It's hard. So I don't think it's that difficult. Sorry, I don't think it's that easy to remake a show.
But you would have thought that the POV thing in itself, like an amazing concept, and brings you so much added stuff that you can't normally do in a sitcom, because why are you in someone's head, especially multiple characters? Like, you have shows with narration, but not two narrations. Yeah. So you would have thought that they could maybe just hang on to that more and then do like they did with The Office, slightly tweak the characters for...
Yeah, maybe they will. I think, you know, we're working a bit with the writer and he seems really good on the new pilot, so maybe it'll be a lot better. I mean, also, but then again, I think the POV thing, although I'm a fan of it, is quite off-putting to people. I mean, I don't...
You heard it here first. Sam hates the POV thing.
I like it. I wouldn't change it, but, you know, the show's never rated that highly. I think Mission Web is so funny and I think the scripts are pretty good. I wonder if that's part of it. People maybe watch it and go, oh, that looks a bit hard on the eyes. I think the VOs are different because that's jokes and that's really fun. I don't know. It has a sort of slightly challenging quality compared to a normal sitcom, which probably hasn't done it any favours in terms of audience.
No, I get that. It's it does make you realise a lot, especially when you see some of the really big broad shows that are popular at the moment on BBC One that really don't really seem to care about the way it looks and the way it's lit, and they're massive shows, which kind of indicates that people at home aren't interested in comedy that looks like it has a certain style or gimmick, or they just want characters saying funny things in funny situations. And
probably true.
I'm not saying that that's what I like. I like a bit of invention, but I think there is quite a big audience that might be like, oh, this all seems a bit like otherly.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of choice, isn't there? You've got to grab people pretty quick.
Yeah, but I do think it had it brought an element to it that you don't get in other sitcoms
as
well.
I think that, you know, we were aware that we had a sort of USP which probably helped get it commissioned. It was, I think, probably quite influenced by two shows that were huge when we were writing it, Royal Family and Spaced, which mm-hmm. were kind of revolutionary in the fact that they made you think visually about a sitcom.
Mm-hmm.
And they were both formally quite experimental in very different ways. Before those shows, I don't think I'd really thought visually about a sitcom as a writer. But that those two shows, and probably especially Spaced, made us think, well, how could you reimagine sitcom?
Mm-hmm.
And I think we have a big debt to those shows.
Did you then, shortly afterwards, everyone come to you for, so what's your next one? Like, silent comedy, or shot from the point of view of the pets, or, like, what was? Were you the gimmick guys? And, like, was it, or did you make it clear quite early on that, no, that's not what we're interested in? Or
I think that we had a happy accident of finding the perfect gimmick for that show, but it's hard to recreate that, so we haven't really been the gimmick mm-hmm. guys. But maybe there's time.
Yeah. Come on, new gimmick. Come on, what is it? What other gimmicks are out there? I don't know.
Maybe it's all shot backwards, like...
I like it, like Memento.
Yeah, or maybe...
Or literally back, like rewound.
Yeah, no, that would be really off-putting, right?
Yeah. You'd get even less viewers. Yeah. Amazing. But you'd be fucking cool.
Yeah, man.
They'd love it in Hackney.
Maybe no one has faces, they're just blank...
That's. I think Charlie Brooke has done that on Black Mirror.
I'll come back to you on that. I'll think about some more ideas.
I like the rewind thing, and then you have to watch. You have to record it and then watch it backwards.
Or maybe everyone wears glasses. Everyone.
Okay. If I don't get cast in that, then something's seriously going wrong. I did a show, How Not to Live Your Life, which we sold to America 4 times.
Wow.
Yeah. So I've been through that. And I think it does make me realise it makes me think that Ricky and Steve, I mean, the jackpot they hit not only creating like one of the best sitcoms of all time in the UK, but to
that?
Then.
Which show was that?
It was cool. I can't remember The Room or something.
Okay, yeah, The Room, yeah, man.
And I was going to say another sitcom, and then I realised that would just be insulting to any other sitcom. But to then have it adapted for America and be a hit again, I mean, that just, it just doesn't happen.
It's infuriating, isn't it?
I'm so pissed off with, why can't I
agree.
Get a piece?
I think people, you know, that's the ultimate example of how it works. And I guess years ago with things like Sanders and Son and...
What was the Alf Garnett one that was called, All in the Family, was it called?
Yeah, Archie Bunker,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, those three examples are probably the exceptions. Yeah. There must be hundreds of shows that have just failed, we never even heard of.
Thousands. I remember seeing, I think there's a Only Fools and Horses one called Only Jerks and something.
Jerks and Ponies?
Yeah, maybe. What is it? Ponies more common than horses in there?
I don't know.
Only Jerks and Ponies. I love this. Hey, Del Boy, get out of my lawn. I love it. But yeah, it just for some reason, I think I've seen the IT Crowd version. But
which
maybe
Richard is in, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Amazingly.
Yeah. I love it. I love it when one component still
remains. Did you appear in any of your American pilots?
No, we never got to pilot. I wrote pilot scripts that were then put forward for pilot season.
Right.
And then the problem I had with my show, and I think Peep Show is probably similar in terms of its tone and content, is that for American network, it was too edgy. And for American cable, it wasn't edgy enough.
Right.
And
Got it.
That's what sort of like BBC Two, Channel Four does that somewhere in between.
Yeah.
So it's kind of because the amount of times I'm going, the character's just not very likable on network. And then I wrote one after trying it a couple of times on network. We wrote one for FX, and they went, "Can you make him more of an asshole?"
Yeah, that's
like,
a good,
wow, okay.
That's a good illustration of your cultural divide between the two, isn't it?
But yeah, well, good luck with the third. Are you involved in that?
Consulting producers, yeah. So we are looking at stuff, but we're not hands on.
Yeah. The best story I heard about people buying formats or ideas from shows or adapting shows or whatever, was someone I was trying to adapt something out there, and a producer told me that they'd just pitched a show to, I think, the Fox Network about a woman that lives with a ghost, and in the room they loved it and they said, we want it. They bought it in the room. Brilliant. The next day they called up and said, we've spoken to our CEO or whatever, our boss, we love the show, we're still really passionate about it, but does it have to be a ghost? So you want the ghost show but without a ghost. I was like, wow,
that's
TV for you. When I was looking at your wiki page, the thing that I was reminded of was a show I really, really enjoyed, and slightly out of your usual wheelhouse, was The Old Guys.
Oh yeah,
I loved that show.
Oh good, thank you very much.
How? That's the first time you've ever gone to like BBC One.
Yeah.
Studio audience.
Correct.
Have you ever wanted to go back and do
Not
that?
Not really. I mean, you know, luckily we have Peep Show and Fresh Meat and stuff to occupy our time after that, so we never really had to wonder about what to do next. But I think I really enjoyed making that show. Roger Lopat, who sadly passed away.
He was so good in it.
And Clive and Jane and Catherine are all amazing actors. So, and I think it was good that we tried that. You know, because that's the whole era of sitcom which we hadn't attempted to do audience. It was fun, but it's probably not my comfort zone.
Mm-hmm.
I think, especially now, the majority of sitcoms, both here in the States, aren't studio audience. It feels like you have to have a really strong creative reason to do that show. If you look at Mrs. Brown's Boys or Miranda or Graham Linehan's shows, they all kind of feel like they should be.
Mm-hmm.
They have a heightened sense, for want of a better word. And we don't really write like that. Or we do occasionally, but our main kind of way of writing is quite realistic. I don't think that's massively suited to that film, mm-hmm. particularly.
There's also something quite frightening about the type of gag and gag count that you have to do that... You don't necessarily in single camera.
Yeah.
You know? It's like it's got a feel and sound much more like a gag.
No, it's horrifying. Yeah. I made the mistake of sitting in the audience once. And when it's not going well, you just feel like diving into a hole and disappearing. Yeah. Because you feel like it's like, public speaking, but...
And there's nothing you can do. You can't stop the performance and recording and go, everyone, can we just do a quick rewrite?
Well, they do that in America, but we don't. Yeah, it's quite exposing for sure.
Yeah, so no to doing that again.
Well, never say never, but it's not probably the natural next step.
What about BBC One? How did you find writing? It was BBC One, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. Yeah. And we sort of felt like we were doing our national service, our national duty in a way, because a lot of comedy writers don't attempt that. And I think it was a good thing to try, and two series is respectable, and I'm proud of the show, but, it's not what we'll probably be remembered for. I mean, look, I'm up for it. I guess I just feel like, luckily, we have the luxury of choice,
mm-hmm.
and certainly all the channels now that you have, you could possibly pitch to, probably just write what you're most comfortable with.
Yeah. And does Fresh Meat, has that also come to an end?
Yeah, we terminated that last year in a sort of blitzkrieg of finality. Peep Show and Fresh Meat both ended.
Why are you doing this to yourself?
Just spite, basically.
Sam Payne.
Again. Just kind of like a confused act of vengeance against people who've really helped us over the years.
Okay.
Channel 4 and all the actors. It was like, no, screw you all.
Do you know what? We're done. I don't care about you guys. There is a creative reason for this as well.
Well, it was a coincidence they finished in the same year. But yeah, I mean, Peep Show, we felt like we'd done 9 series.
We don't want to do the 10. Just to piss off Ian Morris.
Just to annoy Ian. And we just really wanted to kind of end it well, in the sense of having a planned ending and trying to do the best possible series that we could and really working towards that. And with Fresh Meat, it was a bit easier because obviously a college comedy is never going to be forever.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a bit
I'm sure some executives could think of ways of making it last forever. But so was it 3 seasons? 4?
4.
So technically that's like a foundation year and 3-year course or something.
Yeah, well, I can't remember exactly, but definitely it wasn't 1 year per series.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
And that, I presume, having just learned that you and Jesse were college together, that is somewhat based on those experiences.
Yeah, yeah, we definitely bonded over Manchester, and there's no one in the show who's particularly based on us, but definitely we had strong memories of that time and felt it was a great area for comedy.
It seems weird that that show hadn't been, or that the idea for Fresh Meat hadn't been done before.
I know. Well, The Young Ones, obviously, was a student comedy, a very different kind, but brilliant.
But in a weird sort of way, and maybe I was too young to really be aware of this, but I don't think of it massively as about being at the university.
No, it was very anarchic and not really
It's sort of more about flatmates than...
Yeah, I think that's true. Yeah, that's a good point. But yeah, I think you're right. Fresh Meat felt like a kind of obvious thing.
And when you came up with it and the title, you must have gone, yes!
Yeah, I like the title. We came up with it before Peep Show.
Did you?
We came up with it in 1999 and pitched it to the BBC, who didn't like it. It was a bit different. It was similar characters, but half-hour sitcom. And then it just gathered dust. And then after Peep Show, people were like, oh, what have you got in your dusty drawer?
Mm.
So we pulled it out and sort of made it into more of a comedy drama and a bit longer slot. But yeah, it was a kind of pre-Peep Show idea.
So your track record with the book and this, you basically come up with an idea and then 10 years later, you actually make it or sell it.
Definitely.
Or release it.
Yeah. And I'm sure loads of writers have that story. Yeah. I think it should be inspiring, like you said earlier, for people because, you know, frankly, Fresh Meat got made because we were seen to be hotter writers than pre-Peep Show, and it was still the same sort of material. That hadn't changed, particularly.
So no one had mobile phones and Twitter didn't exist.
Yeah. It was but we kind of always felt that show, that emotionally being a student is the same as it ever was.
Yeah.
We didn't worry too much about being old.
Have you ever been approached or tempted to do a film version of any of your shows?
We've talked about Fresh Meat film, Peep Show movie, but yeah, never really got off the ground. I think, again, a bit like American adaptations, the in-between is in the loop. They're relatively rare.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously you can make a lot of money doing a spin-off if it's any good, but it's also quite easy to do a bad one.
It's weird, isn't it? Like, how many bad films of good sitcoms there are? I mean, in the 70s... Everyone was doing them. The fact that there was even an On the Buses, the movie.
Yeah, fact fans would enjoy the fact that On the Buses made more than Diamonds Are Forever.
Serious?
Serious.
How do you know that fact?
I just remember it reading it somewhere, but it kind of rings true because it was a huge show, right? It has a built-in audience.
I'm trying in my head to imagine people going to the cinema to see On the Buses.
Yeah, well, you know, it's the in-betweeners of its day.
Yeah.
I mean, they do it in their droves. And Ab Fab is a big hit.
Yeah, that's true. But you know, I suppose I was going to say it's maybe because it's been so long since they did a show that people are so happy that there's anything, whether it's a film or a TV show. But apparently, it's good as well.
I haven't seen it,
but we'll leave that to the critics. Let's move on to your guilty pleasure. I very rarely have I been made to watch something that I think, I don't know if I can, I'm still trying to digest it all because I watched it last night.
Me too, I watched it 20 years ago, I'm still digesting it.
Yeah, I think I hated it.
Yeah, I think you should have hated it.
Can you tell everyone what you picked as your guilty pleasure?
Film, Matthew, that I'm choosing this week.
I do want you then to come out and recreate the whole film.
It's Bitter Moon. Now, Bitter Moon is not a film that is, you know, Jim Howick was talking about View to a Kill, and, you know, it's not a big movie that everyone's seen, but I think everyone should see it, just mainly as punishment for their crimes.
Well, it's directed by Roman Polanski.
Definitely.
Now, he is considered, when you, you know, forget about stuff that's happened in his life, he is considered one of the greats, like genuine master of the craft. He has directed Chinatown, Rosemary's Baby, some absolute classics. He even directed the film before Bitter Moon, is one of my sort of underrated favourites, which is Frantic.
Good movie.
I love Frantic, and for some reason people never really mention or talk about
it. I agree, it's good.
And yet 2 years or 3 years later, he makes this...
Bitter Moon.
I mean, what genre is it?
Well, I'd call it a softcore psychodrama.
Softcore psychodrama. Which they did do a lot in the 90s.
Yeah.
But this isn't like Basic Instinct or Fatal Attraction.
Much more boring than those.
Way more boring. Oh, my God. I mean, So can you describe the plot? I mean, I could give it a go, yeah. But I don't know.
Well, it's okay. So it's English couple played, thank God, by Hugh Grant mm-hmm. and Christian Scott Thomas. They're sort of in their late 20s at this point, very young mm-hmm. and beautiful, and they're having marriage problems. They're on a cruise, like most people in their late 20s would do, go on a cruise, yeah. Lots of old people.
Yeah.
And they meet an angry, bitter man in his wheelchair.
Already sounding like an amazing plot. Yeah.
And a sexy French younger woman who's his wife. And the whole film is basically the guy in the wheelchair trying to tell Hugh Grant the story of his incredibly intense sexual relationship with this woman in his cabin in his wheelchair. It's hilarious. They keep doing the same thing of, let me tell you the next bit.
Yeah.
Come to my cabin. And they keep having this endless conversation, which you flash back to endlessly.
Yeah, and the whole film is just flashbacks
yeah.
of this story that this man's telling about his erotic relationship with this girl. And the flashbacks go on. The first flashback was so long that when it cut back to him telling Hugh Grant the story, I was like, oh, I forgot Hugh Grant was in this.
Yeah.
And he, every time he goes, hey, come to my cabin tonight and I'll tell you more about my relationship. And he's like, buddy, I don't want to. But then still goes. Yes. And then you're sick, this is sick, and then, but yes. Listens.
It's so wrong, it's brilliant.
And then it's just the flashbacks of him telling
yes.
him this story about how he met this girl,
yeah.
They had an amazing sex life, and then it kind of went
horribly wrong. Dark.
But twisted. Not with too many sort of plot twists or turns.
No, it's very linear, yeah. Quite boring. Apart from the sex, which is quite interesting if you like sex.
Well, it's interesting because I kept thinking that actress is Roman Polanski's wife.
Yes.
And was at the time.
And she's in Frantic.
I remember really having the hots for her in Frantic.
Yeah, she's, see, what I love about this film is that it's both terrible and quite brilliant.
I didn't get the quite brilliant bit.
Okay, what I think it's brilliant about it is all the actors are great.
Yeah.
And they're doing a great... They're putting everything into it. I don't think you could say there's any bad performance in this film.
No.
The script is terrible.
Yeah.
But they're playing it completely wholeheartedly.
They're committed.
And that's what I love about it, because it feels like they're really going for it and telling an important story, but it's utterly risible and ridiculous. And I love that combination. Also, it's Polanski. It sort of looks nice. It's not terribly directed.
No, but there were things in it, like the music, not the songs, not the pop songs that he used in there, but the actual soundtrack music, the score, and then the way he transitioned from someone telling him a story to the flat, that felt like tropes, like real proper...
You're right. It would be a shock to anyone if you didn't know Polanski directed it, right? It feels like a real B-movie by some hack director.
And so then it makes me think, was this some kind of joke?
Yeah, but I don't think it is. And that's one of the things that I've obsessed with this film, is like some of the scenes are totally... I watched it with my wife, who was laughing.
Yeah.
I kept having to pause it because she was laughing so much. But I would love to think, and I don't think it was intended to be funny.
No.
It takes itself very seriously, which is obviously the best way to be funny.
Well, there's also moments in it where it is quite sexy, but there are also moments where it's the least erotic film
yes.
I've ever seen.
And that's what's so great. But I mean, there's a couple of sex scenes which I would say are the funniest sex scenes I've ever seen.
Just bizarre.
So the George Michael Faith one, for example.
Yep, hence why you picked George Michael earlier.
She's pouring milk over herself. George Michael's playing very loudly, incongruously, not as really sexy song particularly.
No.
Then she goes down on him, and as he's reaching the moment of climax, the toast flies up from the toaster.
Which is like something from a comedy movie.
Exactly.
I mean, Roman, if you listen to this podcast, please call in and just tell us, what were you... Was it an experiment? Was it a joke? Do you believe in this film? Do you still stand by it? We just can't work it out.
The other thing I like about it is, I think it's a very French view of an English couple. This kind of like very bumbly, kind of frosty, sexually sort of...
Repressed
couple, and brilliantly played by two great actors, but they're kind of wonderful cliches.
Well, if anything, the appearance of Christian Scott Thomas and Hugh Grant must have had some kind of some kind of impact on them being cast in Four Weddings. So there's probably. If you're a fan of that film, then
the other film from this period, I almost picked, another favourite of mine is Lair of the White Worm. Have you watched that?
No.
Ken Russell.
Oh, well, there you go.
Hugh Grant, Peter Capaldi, Amanda Donahue.
I'm in. I'm sold.
Yeah. Scout scene with Amanda Donahue as a vampire. She picks him up in her car, which is, has to be seen to be believed.
Well, Ken Russell always had a bit of sexy time in his films.
No, he had an interesting period for Hugh. I think that, you know, he was going through a tough time.
It got tougher in the late 90s on a certain street in LA. Do you remember that? That was...
Yeah, I was...
You were in the car. Well, I've not said this before about a film, and I feel bad because Polanski's actually been like one of my favourite filmmakers, and you know, one day I'd like to work with him. But I don't like saying bad things about films, and normally a film's so bad it's good or it's funny or whatever. But this was I did sort of go from hating it to sort of liking it, because then I started to imagine you laughing at me having to watch it. And the ridiculousness of it, and that it's so committed to these long sort of meandering, like you say, you kept saying it's just really boring.
Sorry
in place
about that.
Yeah, but
it's also much too long.
But if you
but you must have enjoyed the scene where he's getting a blowjob and the little dog of the prostitute comes
that was a weird
starts
one
starts attacking him
and he grabs it on the neck as he just lots of weird stuff in it. But if you do happen to want to watch a boring erotic drama,
brilliantly acted, terribly written, quite a lot of
the same two tits.
But
if that's your bag, then this is the film for you.
It's a great 80s pop soundtrack.
Yes. Oh, there is that as well. So in a weird sort of way, I think we've just sold that film. So to play us out, we are going to play another song. You've really committed, because normally people pick just songs or score music from any film or TV show they love, but you've just gone today, Bitter Moon, you've just completely committed to this whole thing. So you've picked the Bitter Moon as the guilty pleasure and both songs from the soundtrack. Just before I introduce it, thank you for coming on. It's been a pleasure talking to you. I can't wait. I know that you've probably got stuff coming up that we can't discuss, but I look forward to whatever you do next.
Thank you.
You're a brilliant writer, and thanks. So here we have, from Bitter Moon, Stop by Sam Brown.
All that I have is all that you've given me. Did you never worry that I come to depend on you? I gave you all the love I had in me. Now I find you lied, and I can't believe it's true. Wrapped in our arms, I see you across the street. And I can't help but wonder if she knows what's going on. Oh, you talk of love, but you don't know how it feels. When you realize that you're not the only one.